Mycotoxins are actually a large group of different compounds. The commonality is they're produced from fungus primarily on that. But as far as the chemistry, there's quite a difference in them. Most people think mycotoxins primarily is aflatoxin, probably one comes to mind first for most people. And, you know, to show my age, when we talked about mycotoxins when I was an undergraduate, you know, it was pretty much aflatoxin and that was it. And for many people, it still is, because aflatoxin is the one compound that will keep you from selling milk. If you've got a mycotoxin level of 0.5 parts per billion, you can't sell the milk. And actually in Europe, it's the limit is actually 0.05. So actually they're 10 times more critical for them than it is for us on that.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Mycotoxins can threaten feed and cattle performance. DSM Firmenich offers a portfolio of solutions to help mitigate the impact of mycotoxins in your feed.
With early detection in health, reproduction, and feeding, SmaxTech future-proofs your dairy operation. Excellent, a novel product for the management of hypocalcemia. It's uncomplicated excellence. Volac, unlocking ruminant potential through nutritional solutions for a sustainable future. Priority IAC, the only company bringing the fields of microbiology and nutrition together. Adiseo USA, producers of Smartamine M and MilkPay.com.
Introducing Ultrasorb R3.0, Volac's comprehensive and complete solution to reduce the negative impact of naturally occurring toxins on ruminants. Ultrasorb R3.0 is a species-specific product designed to mitigate the effects of specific mycotoxins in the gastrointestinal tract of ruminants. Ultrasorb R3.0 also offers lipopolysaccharides binding capabilities. Endotoxins such as LPS can contribute to inflammation in ruminants, with energy partitioned to mount an immune response instead of production. Learn more about Ultrasorb R3.0 at volac.com.
Hello, welcome back to the Dairy Podcast Show. My name is Barry Bradford from Michigan State University. And today, very happy to welcome to the show Brian Miller, who's the Technical Business Manager for Volac Incorporated. Brian, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Well, good morning slash afternoon, whatever it may be. Appreciate it.
Whatever time. That's the great thing about podcasts, right? It might be midnight. Somebody's got the late milking shift trying to learn something. So, Brian, where are you coming to us from? Where are you based?
Well, actually, I live west of St. Louis, but today I'm actually at our headquarters in Buena Vista, Virginia.
Okay, so let's start. You said headquarters for Volac. Tell us a little bit about Volac.
Okay, so Volac is actually a UK-based company.
Okay.
So in the UK, our research laboratories and our production facilities are in Port Talbot, which is on the coast in Wales. And then in the US, we've got a blending plant and again, distribution center coming out of Buena Vista, which is, again, kind of in the western part of Virginia, as opposed to West Virginia, if you will.
Okay, yeah.
So we're still on the side of the border on that. But we have some manufacturing here, and we have manufacturing in the UK as well. So we do both. And then Volac as a company, probably its biggest claim to fame in the U.S., it was the developer of some of the calcium salts, Megalac, which was being sold through Church & Dwight, is now back in our hands. In the U.S. on that.
Okay.
That's probably the product that most people would be familiar with Volac with. But we also are a major manufacturer of silage inoculants and direct-fed microbials. And a big part of our business is mycotoxin mitigation.
We'll have to get into that. Have you ever had any rough work trips to Wales to, you know, do some business back in the head shop?
Actually, no, I went there. I've been to Wales. I've been to, actually, we also have headquarters in other places of the U.K. as well. But I took the train from London to Wales. Well, this will be interesting. I can see the countryside along the way, and the hedges are built up so high along the railway to keep the noise down. So I couldn't see anything but a few trees was all said and done.
The people on the other side of those hedges didn't want to see you as much as vice versa.
Yeah, not the only ones who don't want to see me that much. So I'm used to that part.
All right. So how did you get into this in the first place? Did you grow up in agriculture or did you migrate there?
Yeah, well, it's a little bit of both. I always kind of tell the story. My mother's family's been on the same farm in Iowa now for 150 years. Mm. So I grew up working primarily with the beef cattle side of things. It was a very typical Iowa farm, 500 heads of beef cattle, feedlot cattle, a small cow calf, and 100 head farrow to finish swine unit on that. I like working with the cattle. First of all, they smell better. Second of all, you know, John Wayne never herded pigs. So So I spent a lot of time working there on the family farm. But actually, my mother's PhD is in biochemistry, and my father's PhD is in psychology.
Wow.
My paternal parents, grandparents, were in sales, and I put all those things and put all those things together. That's pretty much what I do: scientifically based nutrition in sales and marketing. So that's where my pedigree all kind of came together.
Tell us a little bit about, I mean, there's one aspect of your career that maybe stands out in terms of, very clear impact on the industry. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, probably the biggest claim to fame was I was developed the use patents for ReaSure, which is a bypass choline product that Balchem markets on that. And I joined Balchem because they had a joint venture. And they were trying to look at bypass methionine lysine. And also they looked at developing a bypass choline years earlier on that. And I came aboard, I looked at the data on what we had at that particular time. And that was several years ago, so I'm not trying to knock anything to do today. But those products didn't do a particular job of releasing in time for absorption. And choline was kind of sitting on the shelf. And up to that point, people were looking at a lot of Rich Urban's work at choline with effects on milk fat and some of those things.
Yep.
And I looked at it and I went, well, What are deficiency signs of choline in other animals? Well, it's fatty livers. Now, where have I heard of fatty livers before?
Yeah.
So, my big thing was moving the feeding from the mid-lactation cows and trying to get a fat response to feeding to transition cows and see if we couldn't get them through that period better. And the first time we fed it, I got a phone call from the farm in Idaho. We're doing about 600 cows and so forth, and he'd split his close-up group. And he said, have you got some kind of flavoring agent in here? Because the cows that are on your product are eating about 6 pounds more dry matter. And I said, gee, I can't imagine that. And I'm like, inside all the whole time on that. And, they produced a lot more milk, started right off. And turns out that I got a little bit lucky. It was an educated guess, but we kind of hit the right amount in that feeding trial. We went back and did a dose response recurve at Cornell. And showed that I kind of hit the level right. But it was an educated guess based on some things that I saw with methionine as well, which is also a methyl donor for meeting kind of those same needs. And it worked out really well.
That's incredible. Well, thank you, because about a third of my most recent publications have been on, using that product. So.
probably maybe the same sponsor.
It's been a really interesting area, just, seeing all the ripple effects of, we don't actually know what all the direct effects are, right? But presumably a lot of it's around better liver function.
Yeah. And to say, just getting through that transition period just has so many, repercussions down the road. It just makes it so much better.
Very well. All right. So you mentioned that probably the biggest products for Volac are around mycotoxin mitigation, which surprised me because I, like others, maybe thought about Megalac when I think of Volac. Maybe we should just start with, let's make sure everybody's on the same page in terms of, what is a mycotoxin and why are they of concern?
Well, again, that's kind of the right way to put it. It's mycotoxins are actually a large group of different compounds. The commonality is they're produced from fungus primarily on that. But as far as chemistry, there's quite a difference in them. Most people think mycotoxins primarily is aflatoxin, probably one comes to mind first for most people. And, to show my age, when we talked about mycotoxins when I was an undergraduate, it was pretty much aflatoxin and that was it. And for many people, it still is, because aflatoxin is the one compound that will keep you from selling milk. If you've got a mycotoxin level of 0.5 parts per billion, you can't sell the milk. And actually in Europe, the limit is actually 0.05. So actually, they're 10 times more critical for them than it is for us on that. And aflatoxins are produced from penicilliums that are really a storage-based problem. Most of your aflatoxin develops because corn is put up at too high a moisture. And a lot of that becomes a problem when you get those, cold nights, warm days, the moisture comes out of the corn, then it condenses back. And so now you've got enough moisture in there to get the fungus to grow, and then you have problems on that. And of course, you can get it in corn silages as well.
Oh, okay.
But the nice thing about aflatoxin is it is reasonably easy to control. And this gets into the chemistry without getting into the weeds too much of it. But aflatoxin is a fairly planar molecule with enough charges. And it turns out a lot of these clintonite like clays, bentonite type clays. They essentially have got holes in them, shelves in them, if you will, with electric charges on it. And so that molecule of aflatoxin can fit in there fairly tightly. And the way I think of it is, if you think about Velcro, you have a lot of loops on one side and a lot of hooks on the other. You stick it in there, it sticks pretty tight, and so you don't get it re-released on that. Some of the other mycotoxins, and the one that's probably the biggest issue for us is DON, deoxynivalenol, and it's a product that's much more globular. And so again, if you think of a ball, and it's got hoops and looks, you only got one spot on the top, one on the shelf, it doesn't stick in that shelf very well. And so it doesn't bind very well to clays. So we need to take another attempt at trying to get rid of those products. But clays themselves work very, very well for aflatoxin. Initially, people tried to handle mycotoxins with activated charcoal. And you will get some binding with activated charcoal. The problem with that is it doesn't tend to bind as tight, again, as the clays do with aflatoxin, but it's rather indiscriminate as to what it binds. So you can tie up antibiotics, if it's a case where you have antibiotics in the feed as well. Certainly vitamins can be tied up with it and so on. So it has some downsides of feeding activated charcoal on a regular basis. And the clays at least limited that part of the problem. But they weren't particularly successful at some of the other mycotoxins. I mentioned DON. There are three mycotoxins that come from the same fusarium mold. And they are DON, zearalenone, and fumonisin. They each have different functions on that, but they all have a toxic effect. Just real quickly on that, DON's main activity is it prevents protein production. And we can talk about that a little bit more. Zearalenone acts as an artificial estrogen. If you look at the molecule, it doesn't look like estrogen, but an estrogen receptor, it looks like estrogen. And so it can bind there and cause some problems. And fumonisin is really a huge problem in equine, but it affects the sphingomyelin and some of the nerve transmissions and so forth on that.
Okay.
So they've all got very different effects on it. The problem with most of the mycotoxins beyond these three is that, of course, the liver is our detoxifying organ primarily, some of the kidneys, some others, but primarily it's the liver. And, if you have multiple mycotoxins, which quite often we do,
right,
whereas one level would not be terrible, when you have two or three of them, you're putting real pressure on that liver to be able to clear things at the same time. Now you add something like being in transition, and having ketosis, and now you get even worse problems going on there. So it really can be kind of an additive effect on that. And the difficulty with mycotoxins can be too, is that it's hard to know what is a mycotoxin challenge and what are the mycotoxin effects that you see, because there's no one thing you can say, oh, that cow's got a mycotoxin problem.
Right.
Mycotoxins make everything just a little bit worse, if you will. And so what's a threat level for a cow in mid or late lactation, that may not be a threat, but that same cow, 30 days in milk, yeah, now that's a threat. And so you really have to look at some of those things as well. Zearalenone, for example, too, is one specific. Again, zearalenone acts as an artificial estrogen. A lot of mature cows, you look at the second parity on, they can actually breed reasonably well. Even if they show some vaginitis, they will actually get bred reasonably well on that. Not so much with the younger cattle on that. Certainly heifers, particularly in the first breeding, if you've got zearalenone, you'll have a problem getting a bred. That's definitely true. So again, you just have to, it's the crime for the right spot, if you will. It's trying to figure out, what animal you're trying to take care of and what threats they see, what challenges they see beyond that.
So one thing I picked up on is you mentioned sort of the possible negative interactions of having multiple mycotoxins there, which is very common. And you pointed to specifically impacts on the liver. Is that because the mechanisms for clearing and detoxifying those are sort of the same? So you're overloading a pathway with,
a lot of them are conjugated and kicked out of the liver that way. And the P450 systems can kind of get overloaded. The cytochromes can get overloaded on that. So there's that part of it. Also, when you get out into the tissue, again, you can be attacking things from different sides, if you will, and causing a problem. And again, just kind of popped in my mind while we're talking about here. Again, the symptoms are not necessarily indicative of that specific mycotoxin too. Usually when people think about mycotoxins and reproduction, they think of zearalenone because of the estrogen effect.
Right.
I've probably seen as much effect on refro from Don as I have from zuranolone. And again, the zuranolone is an area or an area where we're with steroidal hormones, but we have LH and FSH, which are protein-based hormones. And I've seen problems with that because of the Don issues on that. So again, if you have both Don and zuranolone, that can certainly have a double whack on the refro section.
So you mentioned Don, fumonisin, and zuranolone as mycotoxins made by the same fusarium family of molds. Is that then the primary mold that you think is an issue in the livestock sector?
Yeah, it absolutely is. I've seen hundreds and hundreds of assays over the years, and those are the predominant ones that are the issue. And of those, it is far away Don is the main problem beyond the others on that.
Gotcha.
You know, fumonisin for, again, cattle versus, you know, monogastrics, we get some degradation of mycotoxins in the rumen, and that certainly helps on that.
Yep.
Even at the levels we feed are really a problem a lot. And the fumonisin is much less toxic than zuranolone or Don is. So we definitely think of a fairly significant challenge of Don being somewhere around 1,500, 2,000 ppb of Don. Zuranolone being that same general area of roughly 1,000. Or if you talk about fumonisin, you're talking probably 10,000. It's just that less toxic than
okay.
the others are on that.
Yep.
And the other thing too is, on a roll, you know, I think we have more problems with mycotoxins now than we did, you know, 30, 40 years ago for a lot of reasons, actually. One is that, you know, when you're trying to maintain 20, 30,000 pounds of milk, you have a whole host of things that can go wrong that may not have been a problem when you're producing 12,000 pounds of milk.
Mm, yeah.
And so I think the challenge is there just to keep that production up. One of the other things that's really happened with that is with that higher production, we have higher passage rates. And with that greater passage rate, and we tend to have lower pHs in the rumen in general, even if we're not getting into SARA type conditions, we have lower pHs. Both of those lead to a reduction in protozoa numbers. And protozoa are a good system of microorganisms that can break down a lot of these mycotoxins. So those populations are not as high. And just to kind of come back to something we mentioned earlier, that's one of the reasons I looked at, you look at choline in today's diets, because the source of choline is protozoa, and we tend to knock a lot of those protozoa out and transition cows on that. So, but that's, you know, that fits it as well. The other thing that goes with it is that, gosh darn, those plant breeders are doing a really good job of getting plants to be more resistant to some of these mycotoxins themselves. And one of the ways that they do that is that the plants essentially bind the mycotoxin up. And you have these hidden mycotoxins. Great for the plant, not so good when you actually feed that plant. And so now we have more of those issues that come in as well. So those things have all kind of combined on it. And, you know, again, back when I was a kid, we buried everything. Now we have no-till and low-till agronomic patterns. So now we have a good source of potential substrate for fungus to grow on, you know, right on top of that soil.
And re-inoculate,
And re-inoculates. And the problem we have with mycotoxins is not the storage mycotoxins like an aflatoxin. The biggest issue is the fusarium molds. They actually grow in the plant as that plant is growing. And you can't see them. You know, they're... You can see smut, so you say, well, yeah, I've got some molds and I've got some problems there.
Yeah.
But the problem with the fusarium growth is that you just don't know that it's there necessarily.
Oh, okay. They're not the real visible molds.
Yeah, you can't just look and say, yeah, this feed's likely to have mycotoxins. This is done. Doesn't. So, you know, if you look at moldy feed, that moldy feed may not have mycotoxins either. The fusarium molds and just the molds in general, they don't make mycotoxins for kicks and giggles. It's not say, oh, I like making Don, that's what I live for. What they say is, how do I protect myself? How do I make my environment better for me to grow? That's when they make the mycotoxins. And sometimes those systems exist, and sometimes that system does not exist. And so that's why it's really hard to predict in some ways where that's there. You know, at the same time, those molds are opportunistic. If you have drought situations, you know, you have damaged kernels, you've got plants that have been under stress, they're more likely to have a mycotoxin issue than a healthy plant growing in great conditions and so forth.
Yeah, they can't keep their defenses up as well. Yeah, makes sense. So I know you mentioned that there's no sort of smoking gun that, for sure, this is mycotoxins in my herd. What are, you know, often I'll get calls and, you know, this herd is down 5 pounds of milk or whatever. You know, can you help us try to figure out what it is? And it's always often a very frustrating exercise. So how do you help to start sniffing out whether it's a mycotoxin issue or not?
I try and eliminate everything else. It's almost like a diagnosis of lupus in people. You eliminate everything else first. And if you can't figure out what it is, then you start looking at mycotoxins. I'll walk cows. I'll look at that. You look for signs. But again, none of those are definitely one or the other. A lot of times people say, well, I have a high somatic cell count. I must have mycotoxin problems. Well, that could be part of it. But if you think about it, if DON prevents protein production, you could have a low somatic cell count and have a mycotoxin issue as well on that. So it's not definitive. What I usually say is if you look at the production, it's not where it needs to be. You're comfortable first with your transition program that's going reasonably well, and you've balanced your diet. You know, you're lead feeding those cows a little bit, and they're not even getting close to where you're at. And your production is again down 5-6 pounds where you think it ought to be. And you're sure that the guy is mixing the feed right and putting it out and getting pushed up.
Right.
Then you start thinking mycotoxin, but it should be the last thing that you think about. Look for everything else first. And I say that one because I think that's the right way to do it. And I'm a nice guy and I don't want to sell products to people that I don't need. And two is, I don't want you to buy our product and say, gee, that stuff just didn't work. Well, it didn't work because that wasn't your problem.
Yeah,
so let's have the right solution for the right problem on that.
Yeah.
You can also look at, you know, records as well. You know, we always talk about looking at records and how they come into milk and so forth. And, you know, the old line about, well, I got great persistency, so I'm doing a marvelous job. Well, maybe you're just not peaking where you need to be. You need to look at some of those things, and the records will indicate where you're at. If you're again having a lot of breeding problems, but you know you're doing a good, you know, guys doing a good job of checking those cows and so forth, those things fit together. And we all know that high production dairy cows, you know, again back to the energy, negative energy balance, and the inflammation stuff, and some of those things tend to show silent heats or have silent heats. Don't breed as quickly on that. But it's at the same time, boy, mycotoxins can really fit right into that same role.
If you get into a scenario where you've kind of ruled out everything else, and maybe you're helping with the situation, somebody spends the money to do a full mycotoxin workup of the diet, and what I often run into, and I'm curious how you deal with this, is okay, there's two or three that are in the kind of yellow range, or maybe still in the green range, but on the upper end of that. But you know, a lot of people talk about this cumulative effect of multiple ones, but how do you quantify it? Right, it's fine to say that, but how do you put numbers around that?
It really is hard. We have an algorithm that we use. To try and, you know, add the risk factors. You know, are they additive or are they multiplicative? You know, that's really kind of hard to answer to. We take a more conservative route in that, you know, we think of them more as additive, just to not get crazy about it, because again, we want to have recommendations that make sense on it. But it's really hard to say, because again, the next two factors that go into that, again, what's your target animal? Are they early lactation cows? Where are they at? And are they standing in 6 inches of mud and crap, literally? Or, you know, they got a nice clean barn they're working at. Is it 95 degrees outside or is it 60 degrees outside?
Yeah, what are the other stressors, right?
What are the other stress factors that go into that? And so I'm being wishy-washy for 2 reasons. One is I don't know, and two is I don't think anybody can say definitively.
Yeah, that's fair. Exactly, yeah, I mean, we're not to where you can be replaced by a computer algorithm yet.
Yeah, good luck.
Tired of seeing your herd slip and fall? At AgriTrack, our traction milling process transforms your barn floors with 360 degrees of traction, reducing slips and falls while improving cow comfort and preventing lameness, resulting in a healthier herd and a more profitable farm. Visit agritraction.com to learn how we can help keep your herd healthy and your bottom line strong. Modern bacteria create biofilms, and biofilm-related issues are at the core of most culling reasons on modern dairy farms. AHV provides the only program for biofilm management in cows and calves. How much of your herd's potential gets choked out by biofilm each year? To learn more, visit www.ahvint.com/US.
This is good. I think that's really good context. But, you know, then at the end of the day, you know, maybe you end up saying, you know, I think 80% mycotoxins are at least contributing to this problem. So then the next question obviously is, okay, great. What do I do about that? So where do you walk people next?
Well, it's kind of funny. Again, showing my age a little bit. When I was younger and I was first working with dairy clients and so forth too, we had an average herd size of, you know, 60, 100, 150 cows.
Yep.
Well, when you have a herd that small, you can say, you know what, put the product in, try it for a couple of weeks, let's see what it does. And that was cheaper than getting the analysis done. You might as well go ahead and try the treatment and see if it works. Well, now when you got 2,000 cows, that math is not exactly the same.
Right.
But to some extent, you almost need to do that. And again, you should at least do some mycotoxin testing to see kind of where you're at. And also recognize that if you come up with a low level or even if you come up with a high level, that's what that particular sample has in it.
Yeah.
Mycotoxins, because of the level that we're measuring at in parts per billion and so forth, samples is everything. Yep. And, you know, the errors terms that you get from the errors in the lab is relatively minor, but the error getting that sample taken it can be absolutely huge. And so you really want to be careful how you do that. And that's one of the big things, I think, attacking these problems when you look at it. When you see a herd that you think has a problem, make sure you take your sample right. Now, you know, we talk to our guys and people about, we'd rather sample your TMR than to sample your individual ingredients. And the rationale behind that is let's see what the cow is actually seeing, not what's in the feed, nor different feed ingredients per se. The fact you made a TMR and you've mixed everything up and that's gone through that wagon, there's a certain amount of mixing that's already occurred, mm-hmm. versus me taking a grab sample out of a silage pile or coming out of an auger. And then in addition to that, we sample several places down the bunk where we do that, put a 5-gallon bucket and mix it again and subsample. Actually, we tend to vacuum pack it after we've done that before we ship it off.
Yep. I know people have done that. Yep.
Yeah. Just to make sure we don't have any, you know, molds growing, you know, before it gets analyzed on that.
Makes sense. Yeah. I mean, one thing to think about, these analyses are typically, I mean, some companies do it as a service, but somebody's paying a couple hundred bucks a sample, right? So to spend an extra 10 minutes to get a better sample,
yeah.
is a good investment of time to get more out of that $200, $300, whatever dollars.
Yeah. That garbage in, garbage out thing is very real.
All right. So then you get numbers back. You know, I guess typically there's some mixture of, like, you know, feed tools you can add. Sometimes if you got one hot ingredient, maybe you can back that out. Right. But talk me through how you advise people on that.
You know, again, we see at the TMRs, if that's hot, then we'll go back and let's look at the individual ingredients on it.
Okay.
Again, the biggest problem we have is tends to be DON, and that tends to be on that farm. So if you've got corn size that's high in DON and you grow that corn grain on the same farm, there's a reasonably good chance that both of them are going to have a contamination level on it.
Yeah.
You know, the solution to pollution is dilution. If you can find a different, you know, substrate, different source of feed, you know, that's great. But a lot of times that's just not an option.
Right.
And, you know, there are several products on the market, again, that can mitigate the effects of the mycotoxins. As I mentioned, DON, it can be bound with zearalenone and with DON, which are, again, the two other ones we face the most. There are products, we have one, others also have them, that are enzyme systems that help break those down.
So you're not actually binding them, you're trying to degrade them.
We're trying to degrade them, yeah, okay. Rather than bind them. So the DON is converted to DOM1, just a conversion on that. It's an epoxidase that changes it. And the toxicity of DOM1 is like 1/33 of what DON is. So in round terms, if you had, you know, 1,000 ppbs of DON and having kind of a moderate threat level and it was affecting cattle, and you use a product and you drop it down to convert to DOM1, well, now the threat's kind of like 30. Well, that's not down to lowest detection level, but it's the point you just don't care. And again, some product can also combine that DOM1 as well. But again, once it's DOM1, I don't really worry about it too much. With zearalenone actually can be converted into two different alkyls, alpha and beta, just based on the stoichiometry of it. As it turns out, the alpha is much more toxic than zearalenone, and the beta is not. So what we do and some others do is we have enzyme systems that push it towards producing the beta form. And then again, we don't have the toxicity issue with that. So that helps on it. There are other things you can do to mitigate some of those things as well. In fact, I was just doing some, just kind of Google search and lit search recently. You know, there's a fair amount of data that's zearalenone. You're not going to eliminate it, but you can reduce it through ensiling. So again, if that's an option, change on it. I haven't found any papers looking at if in the same situation would high moisture corn be lower than dry corn. I haven't found the data on that. I haven't tested it, but theoretically, it seems like it might go that way.
Okay. I never heard that before.
Yeah. So like I say, so those are things you can look at as well to do that. But you know, the reality is in most cases, if you got on the farm, those guys are kind of committed to having to feed it one way or the other.
Yeah.
You can select a little bit, maybe which pile goes here. If you've got a couple different piles of corn silage you can work with, that's great. And again, people who have it 1 year tend to have it other years because it's there. Obviously the growing conditions change, and so it may or may not be there every year, but it tends to be that way. And then just even the variety of substrates. There was a few years ago where there was one particular strain of one major corn seed producer. I won't say the name just to save them on that. They just had terrible, terrible mycotoxin problems in parts of Texas and New Mexico. And it wasn't their all of their seed corn. It was one particular strain. And so, like I say, there's just a lot of things that go into that.
Well, that's good. I think for me, at least, a lot of additional insights into, yeah, where's this come from and how do you deal with it if you think you're dealing with mycotoxicosis?
It's time for our famous three.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Our Yeast 40, ruminal and intestinal double modulation by ICC Animal Nutrition. Feed solutions that surpass expectations. Learn more about the benefits of working with Schooler. Visit schooler.com/feed. That's schooler.com/feed. Natural Biologics delivers cost-effective solutions to improve health and productivity, helping conquer the rumen health and immunity challenges your animals face. Your partner for extra animal performance, Berg & Schmidt Animal Nutrition.
AgriTrack, leading traction solutions for herd health. Contact us today to boost safety, comfort, and savings for your herd. Invest in the best. Who would your cows choose? Modern solutions for modern cows with AHV. Contact us to beat biofilm-related issues in your herd.
Elevate animal performance with Berg & Schmidt Animal Nutrition, your trusted ally in excellence. Their high-quality feed ingredients like coated nutrients and fat powders provide ruminants with extra energy, boosting health, productivity, and cost efficiency. Unleash your herd's potential with Berg & Schmidt.
The time has come for the dreaded three questions. Hopefully not dreaded.
Okay. Yeah, that's right.
So first of all, you know, you've been working in around dairy cattle for a long time, since grad school at least. What's your favorite dairy-related book or resource?
Well, thank you first for reminding people that I'm old. I appreciate that. But
my job.
Yeah, but I kind of laugh. It's going to sound silly to say it, but the Dairy NRC is a great book.
Mm-hmm.
If you actually go back and read the first part, is how these conclusions were made or how these calculations were made. There's actually really a lot of information there.
Yeah, that first chapter of the NASM is very thoughtful. Yeah, I agree with you.
So that's probably my favorite, you know, resource within the industry, if you will.
All right. What about your favorite book or resource outside of ag?
Well, I was thinking about that, and I finally decided that it really came down to one particular author, Bernard Cornwell. He writes a lot of historical fiction. And it is fiction. It's not historical. It's history related. But he also puts an appendix in the back of each book that you can say, well, he says, I changed this or I moved that. But it kind of fits together on that. They've turned a couple of different books into stories or TV shows. The Last Kingdom on Netflix was
yes.
He wrote.
Yes. I like that show.
And then the Sharps series that he wrote, and it was made into TV shows probably 30 years ago.
So The Last Kingdom was set in like the year 1000 roughly. Is that kind of the era he focuses on or the other?
Well, no, actually he did a little bit earlier. That was actually on the around the times of King Alfred. But also then he wrote a series on Arthurian legend. He wrote one on the, would have been closer to the Black Prince, the French and the British wars back in the, 13th century, I guess it would have been.
Okay.
The Sharp series is based on the Napoleonic War. He has one on the American Civil War. He's very rather prolific. Yeah. So, but I encourage anyone to try it. They're very good.
All right. Last question. In your opinion, what sets successful dairy professionals apart from those who are less successful?
Well, actually, I think it's the same across most different jobs, if you will. I think it's a combination of two things. One is good basic knowledge and expertise in the area. And the second is a passion, and you have to really want to do it. You can have all the expertise in the world, but if you're too lazy to talk about it, well, that doesn't get you very far. And if you're very passionate, but you know what you're doing, you can cause a lot of problems. So you really need you really need the combination of the two.
Well said. Okay. I have to agree with you there. Well, Brian Miller, thank you very much for joining us today. It's been a fun conversation.
I appreciate it.
So this has been another episode of the Dairy Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. Again, I'm Barry Bradford from Michigan State. Just another reminder, if you haven't liked the show or followed it, make sure you hit the button so you don't miss the next episode. And we will see you next time.
Take care.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.